Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. Last week, we listed 20 objections from four critics who claim that Dr. Walt Brown's Fountains of the Great Deep model of the global flood would produce too much heat. It would boil the oceans, cook the atmosphere, and melt the crust. Then, flood expert Brian Nickel and I listed a dozen factors that we'll now use to evaluate the heat that actually would be generated from the events described in Dr. Brown's hydroplate theory. Those factors include directed energy, fusion, expanding gas, and so on. For example, expanding fluids cool rapidly, and directed energy is very different than, say, a forest fire or a nuclear explosion. The four critics represent atheist and creationist camps, and we mentioned that Walt Brown's creationist critics support a competing flood model called catastrophic plate tectonics, and they struggle with their own heat problem called accelerated nuclear decay. Now, CPT advocates, catastrophic plate tectonics, those advocates, they admit that their own model does not solve their own heat problem, even though they acknowledge that this heat would melt the Earth's crust. So to solve that problem, Dr. John Baumgartner and other CPT supporters, they have appealed to miracles, literally, to remove the heat. Now, the hydroplate theory, in contrast, does not appeal to miracles, but it includes physical processes that mitigate heat. Now, incidentally, Dr. Brown received his PhD from MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, from their heat transfer division, of all places, that's in their engineering department, while he was working in MIT's heat transfer lab. Walt Brown's hydroplate theory describes the water for the flood coming up from about 60 miles below the Earth's surface from under the crust through a crack that circled the globe. The water erupted with so much energy that much of the rock and debris that broke off of the crust reached escape velocity and was ejected with that water, much of it, into space, beating up the moon, especially the near side, cratering the other rocky planets, and filling the solar system with dangerous projectiles, including meteoroids like errant bullets. But if super hot water beneath the crust erupted in the fountains and ejected all of that debris into space and caused the continents to slide, forming today's mountains, wouldn't all that work overheat the atmosphere, the oceans, and the Earth's crust? So let's welcome back Brian Nickel, a mechanical engineer who's worked for 18 years in the missile division of a U.S. aerospace firm. Brian, of those three areas, the crust, the atmosphere, and the oceans, where would you like to begin?
I'll take atmosphere for 100, Bob.
Maybe you'll be going for double jeopardy here, Brian, in a moment. Okay, so the atmosphere, we looked at this in our last program. The critics say that NOAA would have had a severe case of global warming, so to speak.
Right. Walt Brown himself has calculated the energy that the erupting fountains would use, especially to launch the debris into space, and that energy would equal trillions of hydrogen bombs. And that's what Walt uses just to get us to understand how much energy is involved.
So the energy budget, which is very important to an engineer, the quantity of energy, well, one critic takes that estimate, and in his argument, he uses the terminology of an explosion so that the general public would picture the heat and heat transfer from exploding bombs. And another critic will look at these, will take an arbitrary percentage of all that energy and claim that this percentage of energy transferring as heat equally through the atmosphere proves that the hydroplate theory is wrong. But recently, Brian, if you recall in the State of the Union address, Apollo 11 astronaut Buzz Aldrin, he was honored. What a wonderful moment that was. And that seems like a better picture, not nuclear bombs exploding. That tells us how much energy, but the Apollo 11 liftoff was accomplished by directed energy by those powerful Saturn V rockets.
That's right. And the two situations you just described are very, very different. For example, say that I plant a tree just 8,000 feet away from a target area, and then I explosively release the energy of Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs 8,000 feet away. And then I do it again and again and again, once every minute for, say, 24 hours. What do we imagine that place would look like?
Okay, well, I think you'd have one burned up tree and total desolation.
Right. After 1,600 atomic bombs of energy in just that one area, 8,000 feet away, would that tree even exist? And I think most people would picture complete destruction and would talk about everything in terms of getting vaporized.
Yeah, sure.
Right. And so certainly in our imagination, we can easily see that that tree would be gone. And that's what they would think. And I think that's an illustration of how most people interpret Walt's example and critique it. But that amount of energy that I just described, where we planted a tree 8,000 feet away and then dropped 1,600 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs over a 24-hour period, one every minute, that is the same amount of energy that is roughly estimated to have been deposited by the 1980 Mount St. Helens eruption in Washington State.
Wow. What happened to the tree then? Now, you didn't go up there and plant a tree before it erupted.
That's right, but there were plenty of trees planted around the entire mountainous area before that eruption occurred.
Mm-hmm.
But let's analyze that eruption. The amount of energy released may have been equivalent to 1,600 atomic bombs, but the type and effect of the two forms of energy in each scenario are extremely different. And just to illustrate how different they are, would you believe that just less than 8,000 feet away from that tremendous volcanic event in 1980, there were trees that survived completely unscathed?
Wow, that's a great point. So Mount St. Helens is so destructive, but you're talking about the type and effect of these different forms of energy.
Yeah, several factors played very tremendous roles in how that energy was distributed, which was not at all the way that atomic bombs would have distributed that same amount of energy.
And you don't take all the energy and say, if just a certain tiny fraction of it was released evenly and spread out evenly around ground zero, what it would do to all the trees, because in fact, it isn't spread out evenly, it's directed energy.
That's right. You have to take some time to study the problem and realize what the situations are, or else you can come up with some very wrong conclusions. Because the blast of the Mount St. Helens eruption blasted off one side of the mountain sideways and then up for 9 straight hours,
right,
the energy was directed. And so trees less than 8,000 feet from the eruption, just on the other side of the mountain at its base, were completely unscathed by the entire event. So in a similar fashion, these heat problem critics make various assumptions that sometimes they don't state or else they underemphasize, and they're of major importance to solving the problem. One way that I tried to demonstrate on a small scale a similar scenario of directed energy is I just took a picture of me holding my hands less than an inch away from the sides of a 1,800 to 2,000 degree propane torch flame. And
I'm looking at the photo right now. It looks scary. How did you take the picture if both of your hands are around the flame?
I had my wife take a picture when I got the idea. I could have held my hands at that position relative to the flame until the entire bottle of propane ran out.
That is, the photo is shocking, especially when you report, and we'll embed a photograph of that clip in our show summary at rsart.org/answers. And so, Brian, why is it you're saying that your hands were not getting burned? It seems like there's two factors going on here. One is insulation. That might be the lesser factor. The other is directed energy.
Yeah, as the gas is exiting the nozzle from that torch, the gas has too much momentum built up in one direction. And so just that small amount of air between my hands and the hot gas is enough to insulate my skin from the heat.
Oh, wow. So the gas is shooting out of a propane torch, and with the momentum of each of those molecules, they're not just going to go sideways and burn you. They're going to keep going the direction that they're going.
That's right. And they can only expand so fast.
All right. So one of the critics, he's one of the anti-creationists, Glenn Kubin. In his criticism, it seems that he is not taking into account, as with some of the others, that an expanding gas cools, right? When gas expands, it could cool rather rapidly. True?
Yeah, actually, fluids being either gas or liquid or even supercritical water.
So as
that would
they
be true of.
Okay, so as they expand, they cool. Now, Glenn Kubin says that the temperature of the floodwaters coming up from below the crust, deep down below the crust, they're what's called supercritical, and Walt Brown acknowledges this. In fact, he's the one that discovered this. So the temperatures were, according to Walt, 1,300 degrees, 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit and hotter. So if there were supercritical water 60 miles below the surface and it jetted up through a linear crack at enormous speeds, as Walt's theory maintains, and as is necessary to eject debris to beat up the moon and all, is it scientifically defensible to claim that the temperature of the fountains as they leave the crack on the surface of the Earth, that they're going to be 1,000 degrees or hotter, as Glenn Kubin assumes that they are?
No, that's not at all the way to understand how fluids expand. And that's the problem. Kubin is ignoring the fact that gas expands and cools rapidly once it leaves a nozzle. And the starting temperature 60 miles under the crust certainly was 1,300 degrees Fahrenheit or hotter. But many of these critics like Kubin and Reed completely ignore the fact that the expansion and cooling occurs very rapidly after it leaves the nozzle. And as the fluid rises from that point way down 60 miles below the crust, at the base of the crack, by the time that fluid flows up and reaches the surface of the crust, where the atmosphere begins, and all life is, by the way, that fluid has cooled and expanded and accelerated for 60 miles. And Walt explains in detail how that heat energy down at the base of the crack would not have remained hot. It would have been converted by that time into kinetic energy. And by the time it reaches the surface of the crust where the atmosphere begins, it has a tremendous amount of momentum in one direction.
So it's directed energy, and the temperature has been reduced tremendously. In fact, Brian, in a moment, why don't we talk about the spreadsheet that you showed me a few weeks back? But we're talking about gas expanding, supercritical water expanding fluids. Deep down below the Earth's crust, the pressure is tremendous. Up here on the surface, atmospheric pressure at sea level is what? It's about
14.7 PSI.
Okay, pounds per square inch. 60 miles down, I know that we've discussed the pressure is hundreds of thousands of pounds.
That's right. With 60 miles of granite on top of that water, it would have been above 370,000 pounds per square inch in pressure.
So the supercritical water is going from 370,000 pounds per square inch to 15 pounds per square inch. So it's expanding tremendously. And therefore, when it reaches the surface, Brian, they're assuming, the critics, that it's 1,000 degrees, 1,300 degrees. But there's good reason to see that it's not even necessarily hot.
That's right. Walt gives an equation in his book, in the footnote of his article on what he calls rocket science. And that equation relates speed from point one to point two across a nozzle and how that relates to temperature from point one to point two. And it shows a very rapid expansion and acceleration, as well as a very rapid drop in temperature as the fluid expands. And so to suggest that Walt is claiming that his fountains, as they race past the atmosphere, are hot, hot fountains of steam is not correct. Those fountains, by the time they reach the atmosphere, could have been very cool, depending on what speed they achieved at the time they raced past the atmosphere.
I recall when you first came to know Walt personally years ago, as I did also, one of the things you did was you got these textbooks that he refers to, looked up the formula that he has reproduced in his book In the Beginning.
Right. These formulas are straight out of engineering textbooks that are well published and, and well acknowledged. One of them is titled Space Propulsion Analysis and Design by Ronald Humble. The other one is by Shapiro, and it's titled The Dynamics and Thermodynamics of Compressible Fluid Flows. And these are straight out of classic fluid dynamics.
Brian, this spreadsheet, it shows temperature dropping as the flow accelerates. Would you give me permission? I know it was not made for prime time, but could I post this spreadsheet to our Real Science Radio Google Drive with our other hydroplate theory spreadsheets so that listeners, you know, the engineers and the ones who are interested could click on a link in our show summary and see this for themselves?
Yeah, that would be okay.
Okay, super. I'm jotting that down. Permission granted. Thanks, Brian. One of Walt's heat critics, Tony Reed, you mentioned a moment ago, says that the atmosphere would be hit with a blast wave. He's one of the anti-creationists. So maybe we could address two of his points, the blast wave, and also he points out that wind, normal atmospheric wind, is created by a temperature differential, even of only a few degrees. And he says that the fountains of the great deep would be at least 1,000 degrees, so that the hydroplate theory would have this tremendous temperature differential. So tremendous winds that he imagines will blow the fountains throughout the atmosphere and the blast wave. Could we talk about those two matters?
Yeah, that's fine. I think, as you mentioned, we've pretty well shown that what he's claiming as the mechanism for producing a wind doesn't exist. He's just not set the problem up correctly and doesn't understand that fluids, when they expand, actually cool a great deal.
If we mention that to him, he may very well know that. He just didn't apply it in his very popular video criticizing Walt Brown. He just didn't apply it. He didn't use it. Maybe he didn't think of it, because if you're biased and you, from the start, think that someone else is completely wrong, you often don't go through the discipline that we're doing right now to really consider the objections against your position.
That could very well be the case. The way that Reed describes what he imagines was that a huge wall of steam was expanding across the surface of Earth like a literal steam bomb exploded sideways across the surface in all directions, and that heat mixed and heated the atmosphere. Reed also claims that steam is a better conductor of heat than air. He says, and I quote, "Heat may not transfer well through air, but it certainly does transfer well through steam, and wind does a particularly good job of spreading steam around."
Okay. So can we talk through
a very interesting statement?
Yeah, Brian, our RSR research team, we meet on Monday evenings. People could join that team. It's sort of a fundraiser for Real Science Radio. When people want to be involved, they can call us at 1-800-8-NYART to find out, 1-800-836-9278 to see how to join that team. But when we were going through Reed's comments, transcribing them and including them in the notes for this program, I recall looking at that and wondering, well, first I knew the fountains would not be hot like he's saying, but when he claimed that heat does not transfer well through the air, I thought, wow, that's a really important observation, because the atmosphere is a great insulator. But then he said that heat does transfer very well through steam, and I wondered about that.
Reid is just plain wrong. It's misinformation that he's spreading, because steam is actually less conductive than air all the way out to 900 degrees Fahrenheit.
Whoa.
And this can be looked up in any steam tables. Just look under thermal conductivity of air at given temperatures versus thermal conductivity of steam at given temperatures, right there in the scientific literature.
All right, Brian, before we continue along this line, you mentioned look this up in any steam table. How about the Kenan steam tables? I think those would be reliable, no?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
yeah.
The reason I mention that is because Joseph Kenan was one of Walt's professors. And we've now mentioned that Walt got his PhD from MIT, one of the world's leading engineering institutions. But it was in the heat transfer lab at MIT where Walt worked. And he got his PhD from the heat transfer division of the engineering department. I mean, Walt was really interested in this. His professors included Joseph Kenan and George Hatsopoulos, true authorities on these matters of physics. Kenan began documenting the behavior of supercritical fluids before anybody knew what they were. I talked about this, Brian, a few months ago, and long before Walt's interest in flood mechanics, he became extremely interested and learned all that he could about heat transfer, and that's what his PhD thesis was about. So Walt is certainly qualified to understand these issues, and he's been thinking them through for 30 years.
That's exactly right. In fact, my engineering thermodynamics textbook by Jones and Dugan, they use the Kenan steam tables in the back. That's what we used when I went through engineering school. So for Reid to err with statements like this and then to claim that Walt and I have not taken things into account or have not realized the real situation somehow, it's a bit hard to take seriously. I'd ask that Reid himself consider his own words and take some time to realize the actual hydroplate scenario and then take a more accurate and scientific assessment of the physics involved.
Yeah, the real science, as he would put it, that's part of the name of his YouTube channel. And for that matter, as we would put it, the real science. So the fountains are not hot and steam isn't a great heat conductor at normal temperatures and the temperatures involved here.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
A few weeks back on a Monday night, Brian, you mentioned to our Real Science Radio research team the significance of boundary layers in the discussion of heat transfer to the atmosphere from the fountains of the Great Deep.
Let's ask a question first. Let's ask, can each particle in the flow of the fountains interact with the first 7 miles of the atmosphere in the second or so that it has as it passes by?
Right. We've already discussed that in about 1 second, the fountains would pass 80% of the atmosphere in 1 second. So you're asking, if we think of the fountains initially at about 6 miles wide and the initial crack wrapping around the earth like a seam on a baseball, would each particle in the fountains interact with the atmosphere? I would think the vast majority of those particles would never see the atmosphere. They're inside the flow.
Exactly. And that means that much, much more than a tiny fraction, even beyond what I think Danny or any of the other critics imagine, is the only amount of fluid that is actually going to interact thermally with the atmosphere.
Wow, what an incredible point. So when you think of how voluminous the fountains were, and you call these the boundary layers, the boundary conditions, when he says, if only 1/1000th, well, it's only the edges, the outside edges of the fountains, and initially the very top of the fountains, that are going to interact with the atmosphere. So all the rest of that has no interaction. It's part of the entrained flow of the fluid.
So in the study of both fluid mechanics and heat transfer, boundary layers are a common concept,
and they're employed to aid in breaking down and analyzing all sorts of problems. Mm. And a boundary layer is a very real interface that happens between the flow and the medium that it's flowing through. And the important thing to understand is that the mass within the boundary layer can't interact thermally or kinetically with the medium that it's flowing through on the outside.
You said it can't. It cannot interact.
No. Material that is inside of the boundary layers can't interact with material that is outside of the boundary layer.
And I'm sure the opposite then obviously is true, that the atmosphere, as Tony Reid was imagining, that the atmosphere is going to be exchanging heat with the fountains, those boundaries are going to prevent any kind of significant heat transfer.
They limit it. There is a limit to how much interaction can happen. It can only happen through that thin boundary layer. Mm. It can't just interact with all the mass. You know, whatever's happening behind and inside of the boundary layer, it doesn't matter as far as the heat transfer equation is concerned. So because of these physical barriers of the boundary layer, it just doesn't matter how much mass is moving within the flow. Mm. The amount of heat transfer that's emitted from the boundary
right.
will not change whether the flow is 10 feet thick or 50 miles thick. So these estimates using unfounded and arbitrary percentages of the fountain's kinetic energy to calculate the atmosphere's temperature,
right.
they're just not very impressive to a thermal analyst.
Talking this through with you now, for me, this is the third time we've talked about this aspect of it. It's really clear now to me why Danny Faulkner's calculations completely miss the point.
Yeah. Think of a boundary layer as a thin wall rather than a flow.
All right.
And whatever is happening and how much of whatever is happening behind that wall to the heat transfer equation, it doesn't really matter. To a true heat transfer analysis, it's not going to matter. What matters is how much heat will that wall allow through it. So for an actual heat transfer analysis, the only thing that will matter is essentially what is the temperature of the surface of that wall.
Mm-hmm.
Now let's think about the fountains at Earth size scale.
All right.
Picture a 7 mile high wall all around the Earth as described by hydroplate theory. And we make the temperature of that wall, say we put a heating element in it and we turn it on so that the surface of that wall is 200 degrees Fahrenheit or 500 or 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Okay.
Or for that matter, negative 200 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 400 degrees Fahrenheit. And we leave it at whatever that temperature is for 40 days. Now think of you over on a continent thousands of miles away from that wall.
Right.
Will any of those temperatures out in the ocean bother any of us
probably,
on the continent?
Probably not. We've already seen that air is a fabulous insulator. In fact, that's what we make most of our insulation with in this modern age of technology is air.
Right. Even the air that is in contact with that boundary layer, even that is going to have a hard time mixing with the air that is stagnant, that is hundreds and thousands of miles away.
Right, exactly.
So the next thing we need to ask ourselves is what happens to that air that is in contact with that boundary layer?
Mm.
And what happens to it? What's going to happen to that air that can interact thermally? Well, let's use an example from the concept of inertia, and that is an object at rest tends to stay at rest, or an object in motion tends to stay in motion.
Mm-hmm.
The atmosphere has tremendous inertia. It's going to take a lot to get it to move. So Walt used as an example in his book of a tablecloth. And we've all seen the trick where you have a dining set out on a table with a tablecloth in between. And then somebody comes up and pulls really hard on the cloth and yanks down on it. And it zips right out from under and nothing barely moves. Well, that's a good example of inertia. And that tablecloth is a good example of the movement of the fountains with respect to the air, just like as if the air is that dining set.
So
and because the fountains were moving so fast, there wasn't much chance for that air to move. I like to use an example of a train. The atmospheric air is kind of like you standing next to a train and you're trying to hop onto a train. Can you get on the train at 5 or 10 miles an hour if the train is moving 5 or 10 miles an hour?
Well, I did that as a kid with my bicycle.
Right.
I hate to admit it, but Hawthorne, New Jersey.
But now, how about what if that train is moving 100 or 1,000 or 25,000 miles an hour?
No.
Right. Good luck, right?
Right, exactly. So that example of inertia with the tablecloth, Walt has that, like you said, in his book in the section titled Test Question. And he sort of immortalized Danny Faulkner's criticism in that section because he quotes from it verbatim. And then he makes this point that you're making, the atmosphere, it's in relative motion, but on this big picture, you could consider the atmosphere as stationary, and the fountains are erupting with incredible acceleration.
Right, and not just acceleration alone, but what direction is that acceleration? It's straight up.
Straight up.
And back to our train example, let's ask another question. So even if you threw yourself at a train that was moving 1,000 miles an hour, what direction will you land after it tumbles you?
You're going to go in the direction that the train was moving.
Exactly. And so just as with the train example, air molecules that are up against that boundary layer, they are getting entrained and pulled up. And so, yes, maybe they're getting thermalized, as Danny uses in his example. But as they're being thermalized, they are being pulled up and entrained along with that flow. So they are rapidly getting moved out of the atmosphere, the relatively thin 7-mile atmosphere where all life is. Even any air that is getting hot is getting moved up to where it's cold.
Moved up to where it's cold. And so it could cool down and then sink back into the atmosphere.
Yeah, they would radiate their heat up in the cool of the high atmosphere.
In that section titled Test Question, Walt also, he brings up frozen mammoths, which I think we may get to later, but he contrasts the extremely hot temperatures 60 miles below the surface in the subterranean chamber, so it's 1,300 degrees or so. He contrasts that with the extremely cold temperature at the upper atmosphere as the fountains are approaching space, where they'll be about at absolute zero. And he mentions that as the fountains are passing up through the lower atmosphere, the water's temperature would have been somewhere between those two extremes. And Walt Brown makes an observation arguing that we know that in the beginning of the flood, a lot of ice fell, and that ice could be calculated its temperature about 150 degrees below zero. So the fountain's temperature was, and these are my words, not Walt Brown's words, but the fountains were like the porridge, not too hot, not too cold, so that they wouldn't destroy the planet.
Right. And even as we showed in our example of the boundary layer with the wall being heated, the temperature of the fountains themselves at the time that they passed through the atmosphere where everything lives is very restrained by that and would really not have affected much of the globe.
Good point. And now, Brian, we've been talking about Danny, who is, again, an astronomer with Answers in Genesis, but why don't we quote him so that we could reply directly?
Yeah, sure.
He writes, "Let's be generous. I'm going to be generous and say only 1/10,000th of the energy mixes, the kinetic energy of the fountains with the atmosphere." And then he goes on to say, let's assume only 1/1,000,000th of the energy mixes. And then Danny goes on to do a back of the envelope calculation and say that even that little bit would burn up the atmosphere.
Right. And that's a trend that I see in all these critiques that you've collected. There are several problems, however, with this methodology. Mm. And first, they'll declare something like, let's be generous. And then they suggest only considering like a tiny fraction of the energy that Walt has calculated. And then they do a calculation and everything seems reasonable to them. And then they get an average temperature and then begin making conclusions. And the whole time, they haven't even set up the problem correctly.
Mm. So with these numbers that Danny calculates, he concludes that the temperature would increase in the atmosphere by 34 degrees Celsius.
Hmm.
But if Danny's even just 25% off in his assumption, mm-hmm. that number is going to drop to only 26 degrees Celsius.
All right.
Temperature change. If he's 50% off in his estimate, then only 17 degrees Celsius mm-hmm. of temperature change occurs in the atmosphere. And remember, all of these are averages over the entire atmosphere.
Right.
And which assumes uniform distribution yeah, of the heat.
Which we have been discussing and we will discuss why that's unreasonable. But what if he's 90% off, which is certainly a possibility? He says this is a back of the envelope calculation. What if he's 90% off?
Right. If he's 90% off in his arbitrary picking of what he feels is a reasonable number, then the change in temperature over the average of the entire atmosphere is only 3 degrees Celsius.
Okay. And that 90%, that's the equivalent of if he would have taken his calculation just to one more digit, tenfold, then Danny would be wrong. So when he ended where he did in being generous, he may have realized that if he went one more step, his argument would fail.
Yeah, let's be generous, but let's not be too generous.
Right. Now, Brian, we've been talking about why it's unreasonable to assume that the temperature will average out throughout the entire atmosphere. Could we get into a little bit more detail about that?
A key problem is that they don't discuss any way of how this mixing would occur on a global scale.
Mm.
And their use of these general equations for finding average temperature and these bold assurances that mixing would happen and that their conclusions are all, you know, reasonable according to them. But as we even talked about with the Mount St. Helens example, that average temperature doesn't jive with reality.
These critics are talking about when the supercritical water below the crust comes up as gas and liquid, whether it's going to mix through the ocean water or the atmosphere, or in Danny Faulkner's case, he's talking about the kinetic energy from the fountains, and he thinks that that energy is going to go through the entire atmosphere, and that's the end of Earth's atmosphere.
Right. In either case, they are assuming or relying on their listener to assume that their average final temperature calculation of 3,000 or 300 degrees is because some form of thorough mixing has occurred, but they never discuss any valid mechanism for how this mixing thoroughly occurs. And showing how this mixing happens is really vital to their argument of claiming that Noah and all life would roast on the planet.
And then if we made that same kind of mistake, we'd assume that everything for many miles around Mount St. Helens would have been vaporized, but it was not. So that's just a mistake.
Right. It's just a matter of not having spent an adequate amount of time to think about the actual scenario that hydroplate theory is proposing.
Mm.
And from a design perspective, this is problematic. In another example, if we just simplistically averaged the heat energy of a Saturn V rocket at launch without taking any other factors into account, we could easily conclude that Buzz Aldrin and his crew would all have been fried as well.
I guess that's true. And they were only, what, yards away from that tremendous amount of energy release.
Right, exactly.
Brian, we're about out of time and we're close to finished with our responses to the atmosphere heat objections. And then we want to address the ocean heat criticisms and the critics, especially John Baumgartner, who say that the crust would melt. I know you've said that you're up for answering all 20 of the heat problems that we cataloged in part one. So if it's all right with you, I'd love to do a part three so that we've looked at all of these 20 heat criticisms of the hydroplate theory.
Yes, let's do it.
Okay, great. Thank you. That was Brian Nickel. And you could get from Real Science Radio, you could get his video on the origin of the Grand Canyon and his hydroplate theory tutorial on DVD or Blu-ray. Just go to rsr.org, click on the store, and I think you'll love those videos. In fact, our hydroplate theory special has Walt Brown's book in the beginning, Brian's hydroplate theory tutorial, and our own Real Science Radio video, The Global Flood and the Hydroplate Theory. You could be an expert if you keep up like this. And so I'm really looking forward to it. And for Fred Williams and Real Science Radio, this is Bob Enyart. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it. to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.